We were talking this morning about New Testament archaeology. We have a little 100-year slot of time where a lot of things happened, and we have evidences that we can dig up from the soil. And we talked about a number of those things this morning. The one I'd like to start with this afternoon we call the Corbin inscription. I don't think too many of you who are here need instruction on what the Corbin was, but I'll just say a few words about it. The scribes and Pharisees instituted laws and traditions that were not in God's Word, but they nevertheless treated them with equal or even greater reverence than the laws that God had given. And in the 7th chapter of the book of Mark, the first 16 verses there, the Jewish leaders were finding fault with the disciples because they didn't wash their hands in the ceremonial manner before they ate. Now, this was not for the sake of cleanliness. It's a good idea to wash your hands before you eat. Good idea to wash your hands regularly, whether you're eating or not. They say that's one of the main things you can do to stay well. But what they were doing under Judaism was taking an eggshell full of water and washing both hands and arms up to the elbows. That shows it wasn't for cleanliness. There wasn't enough water involved. It was a ritualistic purification that was ceremonial and purely ceremonial. And the scribes and Pharisees had decided that this was an extremely important thing to do. So Jesus said, "You guys reject the commandment of God that you may keep your own traditions. Moses said, honor your father and mother, and he that curses father or mother, let him die the death. But you say to your father and mother, whatever I could have done for you is Corban." That means a gift to God. And when we didn't, in ancient Hebrew, we didn't have any vowels, and so it was just four letters. In English letters, it would be K-R-B-N. And that's what we have. I don't know if you can see it from where you're sitting, but we found this little fragment of a stone vessel right near the southern wall of the temple. The temple was built on a flat area, but yet it was on top of a mountain, and so they had to make a flat area on top of the mountain. They built up walls and filled them in with dirt so they'd have a level spot to build the temple on. And just near the south wall of that platform, we found this little fragment of a stone vessel, and you can see on it, well, it's not in English, of course. It would be a lot easier if these were all in English, but none of the things we're talking about are in English. They're always in Hebrew or Greek. And this is in Hebrew or Aramaic. And on this fragment, you can see the Hebrew word there inscribed, K-R-B-N. And also inscribed just beneath it, and I don't know if you can see it. I can barely see it from what I'm looking at. But there are two crudely drawn birds right beneath that, identified as pigeons or doves. Reminds us of Luke 2:24, where we read about Joseph and Mary offering two pigeons. That was the sacrifice that poor people would often make at the temple. So that's just a little thing, but it's an interesting piece of a stone vessel that somebody has found that word Corban was inscribed into. And it ties us into what was being said by the Lord at that time. This is the Pool of Bethesda. It's in ruins now. It's in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem. The 5th chapter of the book of John talks about the Pool of Bethesda near the Sheep Gate, surrounded by 5 covered colonnades. Really has quite a little bit to say about it there, because Jesus healed a man there in the 5th chapter of John. Problem was, until the 19th century, there was no evidence outside the Gospel of John for the existence of this pool. And scholars used to argue, and I can show you books where this is written down. They argued that the Gospel of John was written much, much later on, and probably was written by somebody without firsthand knowledge of Jerusalem, and that this pool was entirely fictitious. It was just totally made up. But we discovered this pool in the 19th century, and it's been proven to be the Pool of Bethesda. Not a big thing by itself, but when you add it in with everything else, it becomes more and more meaningful. This is another picture of the Pool of Bethesda. This is the Pool of Siloam, a completely different pool, also in Jerusalem, though. This is where the Lord, in the 9th chapter of the book of John, had the blind man go and wash. This was not rediscovered until the year 2004, when some guys were doing some excavation work for a sewer there in Jerusalem, they found this pool. The find was announced on August 9th, 2005. And in the plaster of this pool were found coins dating clear back to the time of Christ. The Pool of Siloam is a rock-cut pool on the southern slope of the City of David, which was the original site of Jerusalem, which is much smaller than the City of Jerusalem itself, located outside the city walls of the old city to the southwest. The Pool of Siloam is 225 feet long, and it's in the shape of a trapezoid. Got another picture of it here. This pool was fed by the Gihon Spring. Water was carried into it by two aqueducts. It was first built during the reign of Hezekiah and was fed by Hezekiah's tunnel. Hezekiah's tunnel is very famous if we talk about Old Testament archaeology. The Pool of Siloam was destroyed when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD. This pool was destroyed along with the rest of the city and just rediscovered in 2004 during the lifetime of everybody in the room at the moment. This is the so-called Jesus boat. You may or may not have heard of this. Very interesting thing. There was a large drought in the Sea of Galilee area in 1986, and the water level went down way below where it usually is. And two brothers who were fishermen found this boat buried in the mud near the lowered shore of the Sea of Galilee. They knew what they had right away. One of the brothers, a long time afterwards, said he felt like he'd been walking on air ever since they found it, because he had always dreamed of finding something like that, but never really knew if he would. Never before was such an ancient vessel found so complete. This has been positively dated to the first century before Christ. And this is the only, I repeat, only first century boat that has been found at the Sea of Galilee. It sank 2,000 years ago and sort of became a mud-packed time bubble. Now, I don't know if any of you have been down to visit the Steamboat Arabia or not. Anybody been downtown? Yeah, a lot of you have been down to the Steamboat Arabia. That becomes germane at this point because it sank in 1856 after it, in the Missouri River, it hit a submerged walnut tree snag there. You know, a tree goes down and depending on what the current is doing, it'll sway in the direction of the current. And then if there's a boat coming up the river, you've got that snag right there. And that's what happened to that steamboat called Arabia. It was rediscovered in 1988, the steamboat Arabia was, under 45 feet of dirt in a farmer's cornfield. Rediscovered in a cornfield because the river had shifted a half mile in 132 years. If you've been to the museum, you know how carefully they had to excavate that boat just to get it out of there after only 132 years. Well, how much more careful would you have to be after 2,000 years? So it was very difficult to get the Jesus boat out. They installed fiberglass ribs inside the boat. They filled the whole boat with polyurethane foam. That's not a real clear picture there, but they've surrounded the whole thing with polyurethane to just get it out from where it was and sort of to create the same effect that the original mud encasement had. The important thing about this boat is this could have been one on which Jesus rode. We'll never be able to prove that it was in this world, but it's possible that Jesus actually rode in this boat. It's 27 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, a little over 4 feet high. It's the type of boat that was used on the Sea of Galilee in the first century, both for fishing and for transportation across the lake. We call it the Sea of Galilee, but it's really like a large lake. You can stand on one side of that lake and see the mountains on the other side of the lake. It's not like a sea we'd normally think of in size. But boats like this played a huge role in the life of Jesus while he was here. Boats like this are mentioned 50 times in the Gospels. And this one now is available for viewing at a kibbutz that's near to where it was found. I was talking to some people not long ago that have actually been there since 1986 and seen the Jesus boat. We'll move. That's what they think it might have looked like when it had a sail on it. We move from this to the Erastus inscription, which I think is another very interesting thing. In Romans chapter 16, verse 23, we find Paul saying to the Romans, "Erastus, the city treasurer, greets you." And the Roman letter was almost certainly written in the city of Corinth. Also in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 20, Erastus is specifically associated with the city of Corinth. Now, this inscription was found in 1929, and it dates to the second half of the first century A.D. The letters are carved into limestone paving blocks and inlaid with metal. Only two little pieces of the metal still remain now, but most of the inscription is still visible. And what it says is, and I'll give you another picture of it there, the translation of this inscription is, Erastus, in return for his aedileship, and his aedileship was his position as a magistrate in that town, Erastus, in return for his aedileship, laid the pavement at his own expense. So evidently he was the one who bore the expense of paving this area, and they inscribed it in his honor at that time. Seems very, very likely that this Erastus is the same one that's mentioned by Luke in Acts chapter 19, verse 22, by Paul in Romans 16, 23, and 2 Timothy 4, verse 20. There's almost no question but what this is the same man. And there's another picture of the Erastus inscription. There's a picture of it with some people. I've never been there, but evidently you can just walk right up to it, walk on it, it looks like, if you wanted to, because it's just out there where it's always been, and people, they're going right up to it and examining it and photographing it. And that's in the city of Corinth. All right. Also at the city of Corinth, now that's a little more about the Erastus inscription. Also at the city of Corinth, we have something that was called Synagogue of the Jews that has been discovered there. This shows there were a significant number of Jews at Corinth, which the New Testament says that there were. Right near this, there were found these menorahs, which were probably on one of the pillars there in this synagogue. Typical Jewish decorations. Also from the city of Corinth, we have the meat market inscription. Remember in 1 Corinthians, specifically 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul talks about the shambles or the meat market. There was a big issue about meat offered to idols, and Paul was talking about what you should and should not do with regard to that. Well, here we found an inscription that says that this is the meat market area of the city of Corinth. There were lots of bronze mirrors that were made in the city of Corinth. Corinth was famous for bronze and bronze mirrors, and Paul, of course, cites this in 1 Corinthians 13. Paul talks about now we see through a mirror or glass darkly, but then face to face. Also in 2 Corinthians 3, he talks about we all with open or unveiled face, beholding as in a glass, as in a mirror, the glory of the Lord, are transformed from one degree of glory to another. So bronze mirror and Corinth are largely associated together. This is the Acropolis at Pergamum, and the Acropolis, it just rises up in back of the area of Pergamum. And it can be seen in a number of ways. When the Lord says in the book of Revelation, chapter 2, remember the letters to the seven churches, Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3. In the one to Pergamum, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, it's in Revelation chapter 2. He said a very strange thing to those people in Revelation 2. That he never said to anybody else. He said, you live where Satan's seat is. You dwell where Satan's seat or where Satan's throne is. Some people look at the Acropolis itself and say that that looks kind of like a large throne. I don't know whether it looks like a throne to you or not. You can make up your own mind about that. But they say from certain angles that the Acropolis itself looks like a large throne. There's no question but what Pergamum was a center of Gentile false pagan religion. And some say that Pergamum was the first to build a temple to Caesar. The emperors made the same claims to deity that Jesus Christ made. And the claims of Caesar are viewed as a satanic parody on the claims of Christ. Domitian, the Roman emperor, required people to address him as Lord and God, the same as Thomas said that Jesus was Lord and God when he saw the marks of the crucifixion in the Lord. It's a parody of what the Lord was. Domitian later on, at the latter part of the first century, was calling himself the same thing that the Lord was called. So some have suggested that this whole Acropolis looks like a giant throne. I think more likely it was something more specific. Up there on this Acropolis, there are several interesting buildings, or the ruins of several buildings. One of them here is the altar of Zeus, which I hope you can see that pointer. The altar of Zeus there, and pointing down here. We found this and reconstructed it. It's over in Berlin, Germany now. And this is in a museum in Berlin. By the way, this museum is under renovation right now, so you couldn't go there and get in today. It's supposed to be open next year, meaning 2019 or the year after that, and you could see it again. But this is, it's fascinating because it's the largest, most famous altar in the world. And it's built like a huge throne up on the Acropolis of Pergamum originally. One of the most interesting things about it, and there's another perspective on it. You can see how big it is from those people that are in some of these pictures. One of the most interesting things, though, are these motifs. That's an actual model looking down on it in that center part, which is where they had sacrifices made. But in these reliefs, these bas-reliefs, there would be legs of the giants. It's called the Battle of the Gods and Giants. And some of the legs of these giants were actually, they turned into serpents. One of the motifs of the city of Pergamum was the serpent. And you see that over and over again. There's more snakes there. And the title of the god that was worshipped here was called Zeus, but Zeus Soter, Zeus the Savior. Again, a parody of the Lord, Zeus the Savior. This is a rather spectacular frieze of the Battle of the Gods and Giants. And it continually, over there's another snake there as you're going up the steps. Because Pergamum was the home of Asclepius Soter, or Asclepius the Savior, known all over the world as the Pagamene God. Asclepius was the god of healing. He was worshipped always under the form of a snake around Pergamum. Galen, the physician, was the second most famous doctor in the ancient world after Hippocrates, and he came from Pergamum. Later he moved to Rome. These people were pretty good with medicine. They had dissected the brain, they dissected the heart, they knew about the venous and arterial systems, they knew how to take a baby by cesarean section. There was a great medical school at Pergamum, the Caduceus, that we still have on our medical buildings today and is associated with the medical practice. Two snakes going up a pole, that has association from back in the time of Pergamus. But the thing I wanted to show you is at the temple of Asclepius, and I'm only showing you one little section of it here, this healing tunnel. We may have talked about it before. If you were ailing, you could go into this healing tunnel and spend the night there. You'd lay down and sleep on the floor there, and they kept a whole bunch of harmless snakes in there. And for healing, you just lay there and sleep on that floor for one night, and those snakes would slither around all over you. And I'm not sure how the healing worked, but I think the next day when you got out of there, away from those snakes, you did feel better. That's the way I think the healing must have worked. Anyway, we've discovered these things, and it helps us to understand things like when the Lord said, "You dwell where Satan's throne is." Now, this is the site of the temple of Diana or Artemis at the city of Ephesus, another one of the seven churches. This was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world when it was in its heyday. It was large. This is the only thing left now. We've just piled up these stones there so people will know where the temple of Diana was, because it hasn't been there for a long time. But there have been artist renditions of it like that. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, 425 feet long by 220 feet wide, 120 white marble columns going 60 feet into the air and supporting a massive marble roof. Each column was said to be the gift of a king, and 40 of the columns were covered over with gold, and the temple in this form took 120 years to build. These are other artists' conceptions here. That's an actual model that they have, but we don't know precisely what it looked like, but we know it was a magnificent structure for that day. When Paul wrote to that congregation in Ephesians 2 and said to the church, "You are built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together groweth up unto a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are built together for a habitation of God through the Spirit." He was writing to people who knew what a temple was. They lived right there in the shadow of this big thing. And they understood that when he said, you are a temple, they understood what a temple was, that it was a structure for deity to be worshipped in and worshipped with. So that was pretty important. This is the theater of Ephesus where Paul was rushed. Paul and some of his friends were rushed. We have discovered it and partly reconstructed it. Very interesting theater. There's another picture with people in it to show the size of this theater. This is Sir William Ramsay, and I put him on here because this man just really did a lot of good for me when I was young. I can't even tell you how much I enjoyed his books when I was young. I would sit on people's front porches while I was holding meetings various places and read Ramsay's book. The thing that interested me about Ramsay is that he was under the sway of German higher criticism during his early life. It said that Acts was not written until much later than the events it purported to record. And Ramsay didn't think that the book of Acts could possibly be right. And so he set out to show that Paul could not have taken the trips as described in the book of Acts. And he said, I'm going to try to retrace these journeys and show that it's impossible to do it, that the book of Acts has to be wrong. And he ended up proving that it takes more faith to disbelieve the Bible than it does to believe in the Bible. When he first went to Asia Minor, many of the cities mentioned in Acts had no known location and almost nothing was known of their detailed history or politics. The Acts of the Apostles was the only record, and Ramsay was skeptical, fully expecting his research to prove that the author of Acts was hopelessly inaccurate. He therefore set out to put the writer of Acts on trial. He devoted his life to unearthing the ancient cities and documents of Asia Minor, and after a lifetime of study, he concluded, further studies show that the book could bear the most minute scrutiny as an authority for the facts of the Aegean world, and that it was written with such judgment, skill, art, and perception of truth as to be a model of historical statement. He ended up believing that Luke was one of the best historians who ever lived when he believed just the opposite when he started out, and he was trying to prove just the opposite. This is not somebody that was on our side. This is not somebody who was taking the Bible and trying to prove it. He was trying to disprove it. But the facts made him change his mind, and that's why I'm so impressed with Sir William Ramsay. He said, I set out to look for truth on the borderland where Greece and Asia meet, and I found it there, that is, in the book of Acts. I found truth in the Bible rather than finding what I thought the truth was going to be. And then he said, you may pray, I'm selecting from various sources here because he did a lot of writing, wrote at least 10 books. He said, you may press the words of Luke in a degree beyond any other historians, and they stand the keenest scrutiny and the hardest treatment, provided always that the critic knows the subject and does not go beyond the limits of science and of justice. Now, he wrote that in 1915, and I'm saying now that today, 103 years later, the same thing can be said with even more certainty of the entire New Testament. David put it this way when talking to God, the entirety of your word is truth. Psalm 119, verse 160. Well, this is a Capernaum synagogue. This one is actually built on top of the one that Jesus went to. We can't get to the one that we want because this is the one on top of it. That's often the case, you know. Everything is on top of what you really want. And so we know it's down there, but we can't, or we're pretty sure it's underneath there, but we can't get to it the way we would like to. That's a picture of what people think. This is the house of Peter at Capernaum. It's almost undoubtedly authentic. We have traditions going clear back to the first century. When Jesus went to Peter's house and he healed Peter's mother-in-law, this is right there near that synagogue. I've been to it myself. Today, they have a religious structure built over the top of this house. When I was there 40 years ago, that wasn't true. And you could see it just out in the open like this. And it's amazing to stand there and think, well, I wonder which room they were in when Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law. It's got to be one of these rooms, although that house has been added on to over the years. But it was right there that happened, and it's an amazing thing to think about. This is the Arch of Titus in Rome. We're almost done. The Arch of Titus in Rome, this is a relief on that arch showing, and I don't know how well you can see it there, but this is the menorah, the seven-pronged lampstand there. When the Jews were being taken captive to Rome after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, this Arch of Titus was made to show his triumph over the people of the Hebrews. And the menorah, the silver trumpets are on there, the altar of incense or the table of showbread are on there. This is that you can see the menorah better on there, the menorah and the trumpets. This is called the Nazareth inscription, which is in the city of Paris today. It was not too long after the resurrection of Jesus, and this Nazareth inscription, we don't know if it has anything to do with the resurrection of Jesus or not, but it's the authorities arguing against grave robbing, saying how people should be prosecuted for grave robbing because some people think maybe it's because they were trying to make the case that the body of Jesus had been stolen away by the disciples. We acquired this in 1878. This is the Herodium. This is the last thing I'll show you because our time is about gone here. The palace fortress built by Herod the Great. We always thought it was as his burial place, but we couldn't prove that until just recently. This is about 7.5 miles south of Jerusalem. It's a mountain that has been partly constructed by man to have this perfectly conical, symmetrical shape. And all through the years of my adult life, it's always been a mystery as to where exactly Herod's body was buried. We know he built this as a place to be buried, but was he really buried there? When I was in Israel in 1978, we drove by this Herodium, and it was discussed that Herod was supposed to be buried there, that Josephus said he was buried there, and in 1978, I was told, we're looking for his tomb. Maybe on some of your trips over there, you've been told the same thing. We're looking for his tomb. We're looking for his tomb. Josephus said he was buried in the Herodium. And we were told quite a lot about the funeral procession of Herod in Josephus, that he was laid out in purple grave clothes and all of that. There were hundreds and hundreds of people involved in this funeral procession for 25 miles all the way down there. And it was there that Herod was buried. But it's a big place. So where was it? Well, until 2007, we didn't know. And at that point, a professor of archaeology at Hebrew University by the name of Ehud Netzer discovered it. He'd been looking for it for 35 years, started looking for it in 1972. Finally, in 2007, he discovered it. And now that's the top of it. He actually discovered it right here, about halfway down the mountain. There's the mausoleum, and he's shown that this was it, and there's a lot we could go into about that, but it's not that important. The sarcophagus was scattered into hundreds of pieces. The monument had been destroyed, we think, during the revolt of the Jews against the Romans way, way back. But these Jewish rebels were known for their hatred of Herod, and so it would have been likely that they would have tried to destroy his tomb. This is Netzer there on that mountain with the decorated red limestone fragment near the remains of Herod's tomb. He later on fell and seriously injured himself at this dig in the Herodium in 2010 and died 3 days later. So he was doing this work right to the end of his life and in a sense gave his life for this work. Well, that's a little bit about New Testament archaeology, and I hope that it's been profitable to you. I appreciate the positive feedback that you gave me during the break with regard to this. That helps, because when I couldn't get it going this morning before Denny got here, I was thinking, man, I shouldn't have even attempted this. But Denny got it going, and there's nothing like seeing the pictures. I'm not a big PowerPoint guy, as you can tell, but on something like this, to see the pictures, if you can't show the pictures, there might not even be much use talking about it. Anyway, I hope that it's profitable for you. We're going to conclude once again by extending the Lord's invitation, because we don't know the hearts of those who are present. If we can assist anybody in any way at this time, come up to one of the front seats and let us know as we stand together, sing together one more time.